Session number 14806, Eddie Murray, part 31.
You were saying that you went down to this place in Alton.
Yeah.
And for the Churchill Trust inauguration, where Montgomery was, and Montgomery just had avoided the thing completely.
I mention it because I know for a fact that Monty's place wasn't very far from Alton. And I think that still is the seat of the Montgomery's. I suppose he had his reasons.
Yes. Did you speak to Montgomery much? Or?
Oh, down there? Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
He wasn't hunchbacked like, but he used to keep his head down and his shoulders sort of rounded, and he would slouch across to me, and we'd talk military matters, you know.
Yeah.
And he would be interested in the Foreign Legion.
Yes.
You know, and my part there.
And but Montgomery, and he stopped speaking to his son, and on the whatever it was, the 10th or 15th or 20th, whatever anniversary it was of the D-Day, he held a special. I don't remember, probably the 10th one. He held an anniversary ball or something, and he didn't invite Eddie de Gingon, who was his chief of staff. And Eisenhower found out about it, and he just handed the ticket back.
Oh, I see.
Well, I don't know. I only mentioned that because I thought you would know more about it than I did.
I haven't heard about that.
Mm.
No.
But he got on well, Monty and...
So, incident.
Yes.
Well, they appeared to. I think Churchill was... No, I was going to say he appeared to be bored. That wouldn't be quite true, really. Because he always looked bored, Churchill did,
really?
From a distance.
Yeah.
And in the summer days, when they were sitting out on the lawn and at a table, and I would go, you know, some distance away, I didn't want to know what they were talking
yes.
about. You know, I always was so discreet as far as that sort of thing was concerned, that it always astonished me, or it has astonished me, do you say, in later years, that they could have thought that I was capable of... Of doing the dirty as far as there.
But that's the papers secretary, or who?
The secretaries. Well, I don't know. I had a letter from one of the secretaries. You'd not believe this.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Churchill program, you see, on television, and the runner-up, the trailers, and the Radio Times, as a matter of fact, gave a picture of the hostess at La Pausa, Emery Reeves's wife. Emery Reeves's wife, Wendy. And she said that, he came down there to be happy, and I made sure that I kept him happy. Well, you see, what can you read into that, you see? And there were also other suggestions of that type. And it made me so cross, you see, that I immediately wrote up to the Sunday Times, the Radio Times, and I wrote to the Sunday Times and the Telegraph. And both the Sunday Times and the Telegraph published my letter, you see, of saying that that was absolutely ridiculous and, you know, not really very correct. Refer to have said these words and suggesting
impropriety,
that sort of thing. Yes, pretty much so. Then the Radio Times wrote back and said that I got the wrong idea about it. Forgotten his name. Nevertheless, he was the producer. I got the wrong idea about it, and he suggested that I wait for the series and then write to him afterwards and we could discuss it. Well, eventually the series came along, and there was only about 2 or 3 seconds of her, and she never said anything like that at all. But following my letter...
But I do remember her saying that in the series.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it was...
But it was...
It was quite ineffectual and not what would
have
been
written at
the time. But I think
in the series...
In the Radio Times.
Thinking back on it, they seemed to make... I mean, whether it was with that woman or not, that they made the point that it was considered that Emery Reeves, who was his book agent in Europe,
mm-hmm.
wasn't a good influence on him one way or another. And I got the impression from your book that the Emery Reeves setup wasn't the top of wouldn't exactly be the top of your Christmas card list.
No, but I'd been influenced, you see, because as soon as I was told that we were going to Reeves.
Mm. And Montague Brown didn't like it either. He's on record as saying he's on
really
on the films mm-hmm. saying he.
I can't remember the film at all. But as far as Reeves is concerned, you see, before we went there, and this is quite a long time after he'd been the Continental editor, and I can't remember exactly where it was, but he was found to be guilty of. What is it? Not pragmatism. Of publishing words that had already been published, you know.
Plagiarism.
Plagiarism, that's right. And so, I suppose for a certain time, with this more or less hanging over, he said he couldn't come to England. But then, during the war, he applied for naturalisation.
Well, what nationality was he normally?
Hungarian, I believe.
Oh, so Emery Reeves was just an assumed name, basically.
Yes.
An adopted
probably
name.
Probably Revesh, with a Z on.
Okay.
Something like that.
Yes.
But in any case, it's over 30 years ago, isn't it?
Sure.
And so, I went up to Criminal Records Office, you see, to look for him.
Yeah.
And I found him there for this plagiarism.
Oh, really?
You see, and not only
well, it's
that...
Well, it's a copyright infringement, isn't
that's
it?
That's right.
Yeah. That's a criminal affair, but a criminal copyright infringement.
Criminal, that's right.
Yeah.
And so and it was dealt with in court and all the rest of it. But the main point is that I found his application for naturalization signed by Clement Attlee, Lord, I believe it was Anthony Eden, and Lord... was also a member of the Conservative government, so he wasn't Home Office, but some office anyhow.
Mm.
So it was signed by three very, very important people
from
political
world,
you see. And it was also signed as a fourth, and you only require three.
Sure.
Signed as a fourth, you see, by Winston Churchill.
When did he apply for naturalisation?
It was during the war.
During the war, huh?
And then this is probably the most indiscreet thing I've ever said, is that it was refused by MI5.
Really?
And he must have...
Even without interviewing him?
Oh, no, he was probably
interviewed.
I'm sure it went through the correct channels. But, of course, everybody would be impressed.
Really?
Not suitably, but unsuitably, probably, by the collection of signatures that were on there. And it was refused, and it came back to Churchill.
Who was the Prime Minister?
Who was in power, the Prime Minister. And he ordered them to accept.
Well, who was he to anybody then, before the war or at that time?
Nobody, except that he was to be Churchill's Continental Editor.
Once the war was over.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a possibility, of course, that he was... but if he'd been assisting MI5, they would have been the first to...
Who said yes.
But apparently there was that suggestion that he was giving information, you know, from the continent into British hands. But nevertheless, it was Churchill that swung it, no doubt about it. And I shouldn't be saying it.
Mm.
So we'll erase that, shall we?
Well, we'll see, yeah. But really, that's amazing. But only if it had been supplying information by whichever means, then that would have got back and would have been thought to have been a good boy.
Yeah, there is that possibility.
Mm. But Amory... Montague Brown was saying that Churchill had fallen too much under the spell of going over to Emery Reeves' place and spending time there, and didn't like it, didn't feel it was a good idea, and Lady Churchill didn't feel it was a good idea. Lady Churchill didn't go along, and all the
she
rest
went
of
there
it,
once
and didn't like it, and didn't go, would refuse.
But
more
she never
or less.
Said she didn't like it. She just went there and made it made sure she didn't go again.
Yeah.
Well,
what was it not nice there? I mean, what was this?
It was wonderful.
Hmm?
Cold, very cold.
Yeah.
It was all, I mean, it was built of marble. It was the Duke of Westminster's place. And the Duke of Westminster, of course, had had a mistress called, oh, the famous designer, dress designer, couturière, perfume. She died.
Not Coco.
Coco Chanel.
Oh, Coco Chanel.
Coco Chanel.
Oh.
You see? And so it used to belong to Coco Chanel rather than the Duke of Westminster, I believe. Or vice versa, I don't know. Not sure. But I know there's some something there. And Reeves bought it from Coco Chanel.
Well,
and it's a wonderful place, but it's built of marble and absolutely cold. And there's a Rodin in the hallway as you go in. And some sumptuous rugs on the floor. And open fires. And heating system. Now, as soon as Churchill went to bed, Reeves used to shut the heating off and wouldn't put it on until Churchill woke up the next morning, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock, by which time, of course, the house, everything in the house was
frozen.
Ice cold, freezing.
Yeah. Even in summer?
Yes, very cold in summer. It's perched upon a mountain, halfway up a mountain, above Menton. A cold place surrounded by lavender bushes. Beautiful, really beautiful.
Was there a bad atmosphere there with the sort of the servants, etc., got the bums rush off him, basically? I don't know. It's
no.
A trivial
there was hardly any servants there at all.
Right.
And so there was a maitre domo, if you like, and a girl. And then, of course, the valet used to help. And I used to sleep in an outhouse above the carriage. And it was so blooming cold, no heating there at all. And so I had to borrow from town an oil heater.
Good Lord. So it was a funny little setup, all that.
It was a funny setup, all right. Now, as a result, of course, of my writing about this, this series that was coming out in the Radio Times, the producer of the program writing to me to tell me to wait. But in the meantime, I've written in my letters published in the Times and the Telegraph. And immediately afterwards, young Winston, a couple of days later, wrote to me, congratulating me and thanking me, you know, for jumping to the rescue.
Good, yeah. What was the origin of Wendy then? She was English, or?
Oh, no, Wendy was from New York. She'd been a model in America, in New York.
Uh-huh. Yep. Okay.
And I mean, she was no, wasn't. She was very. She was quite attractive.
Yep.
You know, she was tall and slim. Mm. I mean, there's no. She didn't attract me in any way. You know. But she was very vivacious, and she saw to everything that Churchill wanted. There's no doubt about it. You know, he'd sit there, and she'd sit at the fire, and she'd see, you know, an ashtray, if you like, and. The cigars were there and matches, light his cigar and all that sort of thing, and spoon him caviar of an evening, you know. All those little things that Lady Churchill never did. But
he didn't mind being pampered at all, though.
He'd never been pampered. So he relished it.
Sure.
And it was. And so it's unfair to say that. It would be unfair to say that Churchill didn't like it, that he went there for any other reason than because he was being pampered there. And it was a beautiful place, and it was paintable, and he did a couple of paintings. And when the weather was bad, and it was often bad, even during the winter, there'd be snow on the mountains around Monte Carlo, they would insist upon getting a table out and his paints out, or their paints out, and paintbrushes and a canvas, so that he could copy Cézanne, for instance, Still Life by Cézanne. Mm. No. And I've got a nasty feeling that those paintings were not to be taken home.
Yes. How did Churchill and Attlee and the rest of them meet this fellow, Amory Reeves, then? Reeve.
I didn't go into that. I don't know whether Attlee and Lord... It's not Wilson, Lord. I can see his face there, on the quayside, at outside the Festival Hall, the South Bank, there on the dock, what do you call it, on a pontoon, if you like, where the harbour guard is, and Britannia's out there, when Churchill went aboard, you know, for lunch on one occasion. And I can see him there because he was...
This is who we're talking... This is...
A Lord...
A Labour peer.
Was he Labour? I think he's probably Labour peer. Mm. Yes. Do you see? And... no, I can't remember.
All right.
But okay. It's a material. But he signed the naturalisation papers as well. As to whether or not they'd... It had been suggested by Churchill for him to get... Or whether Eden was... mixed up in the business. I don't know.
Well, Eden signed as well, did he?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm. How did Churchill get on with Eden? Because it said that Eden in this program, that Eden had been waiting to take over from Churchill for ages, and he thought that Churchill was going to say, "Oh, so, you know, you carry on."
And well, Churchill didn't trust him.
Really?
Churchill was fully aware of the fact that Eden was a wonderful foreign secretary. Mm. He had it all there. I mean, he was debonair, and he travelled well, and he was good to look at. He knew all the diplomatic ins and outs. But he was a sick man.
Eden.
Mm. He was, for years he was a sick man.
Mm. And what did he have, a liver or what was it? I forget now, something, or a pancreas or something like that.
No, I can't remember.
Yeah.
Then he married Churchill's niece,
or
niece twice removed, or something like that. And she was a... Oh dear, better not. She's still alive. For me, she always represented the aristocratic Catholic. You know, she was very solemn. She looked always to me as if she'd just come out of a convent.
Oh really?
She was always, nearly always dressed in black. I think she's changed a bit since her husband died.
Uh-huh.
And as Lady Eden, she sort of had to fill a role. But I don't think Churchill trusted Anthony Eden as a prime minister.
But he did. But he approved of him as obviously as foreign secretary.
As a foreign secretary, yeah. Yes, indeed. And then he wanted to stay on as long as he could. Let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
That was Churchill's ambition, I'm sure, to die in the House of Commons.
Really?
I always felt that.
Really? You wanted actually...
You wanted to...
Pop his clogs in the House of Commons?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. And on the front bench, if possible.
But you... I mean, is there anything more than...
No, no.
Than the supposition that made you
the
think...
The supposition, that? Absolutely.
Yeah. And he spent... Even his leisure hours there, more or less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he loved going to the House of Commons.
Mm.
And I'm not sure whether it was to listen to the debates that were taking part, but I remember when, I used to sit in the in a box, which was the personal hideaway, if you like, for his guests only of the sergeant at arms,
right.
And he permitted me to go there. Do you see? It's just behind the box where the messenger underneath the Churchill Arch. Just to the right of that. And it's just, there's a, maybe half a dozen pews there. And there's a sort of a fence in front, a barricade in front, but just about chest high. And so one can see and hear everything that goes on in the house, in the chamber.
That's the, not at the speaker's end, the other end.
That's at the other end.
Yeah, okay.
It's
yeah.
Churchill Arch, at the okay. lobby end.
Right.
And, it was Barbara Castle that was up, standing, talking, and I could see him. You know, I've got a bit of a propensity for lip reading. I astonish Beryl very, very often by telling her, you know, what the people are saying. And so, you know, I could, you don't have to be a magician to read when somebody's saying rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. Mm. And while she was talking, there he was, rubbish, rubbish, and she was looking across to him because she could hear it as well.
What opinion did Churchill have of people like Barbara Castle or Gateskill? Two entirely different people.
Very different people. Mm. No. They were the antagonists. I mean, they were the opposition, and they were the communist-minded, really, Reds. Mm. You know, the super socialists. Mm. Whereas Attlee was a different kettle of fish.
Mm.
Attlee was a friend, and they'd been together through hard times, and they'd seen eye to eye on most things as far as the war was concerned.
Really?
Mm. And they were friends, really.
Mm.
But of course, in the House of Commons, all friendship ends. But
Did he have much to do with? One thing it says in all these things is that own emotions, that own Churchill and Attlee, the sort of people are crying every other moment and all the rest of it, or not every other moment, but you know what I mean. There's a lot more emotion in it than not to do with Attlee specifically, but in a lot of.
He was a very, very emotional person, was Churchill. Mm. And when he and Attlee used to get together for drinks, when one or other of them was in power and the other in opposition, you know, they used to meet pretty frequently. And, well, you know, in the House of Commons, I mean, not outside.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't socialise outside.
Mm-hmm.
But in the House of Commons, you know, they would meet and discuss things that had happened in the House. And argue about them a little bit, but they would also always have scotch and soda each.
Mm-hmm.
but they never left each other's presence without tears streaming down their
really?
Cheeks.
Really? Good gracious.
Never. Yeah. They were very, very emotional as far as the war was concerned.
Mm. And what about, and you said also that he was emotional when he'd led you up the garden path by absconding from the hotel.
Well, there he was in bed, and he was, you know, he thought it was dreadful of himself to have been coerced into it. But he would not lay the blame on Lady Churchill, never.
Right.
You see, he said, I know it was not your fault. His first words.
Right.
I know
right.
it was not your fault, my
right.
fault. And he'd already signed the cheque for £50.
Right.
But he wouldn't say, you know, Lady Churchill told me it was all right. Or anything like that, you see.
The other thing they went on about on the programme was that he was depressed all the time.
No, as I said before, he always seemed bored, you know, from a distance.
Right.
And it was only when you got closer that you saw the life in those eyes of his, do you see. And very often he would smile to himself and... Yes, quite often. There would tears be trickling down his cheeks, you see, even although he was on his own and nothing had been discussed. But his mind would go back to awful things that had happened, particularly during the war, or if somebody had been unkind to him.
Really?
You know,
who was unkind?
Like Nye Bevan, for instance, in the House.
Right.
Who'd take a particular stand against Churchill and conservatism. I mean, and Churchill didn't like him at all, but he was a wonderful orator, was Nye Bevan. But he would be touched, moved, when nasty things were said about him. Well, whether they were true or not true, it didn't make a heap of the difference.
Mm.
Churchill thought a lot of himself, there's no doubt about that, you see. And so he felt that he'd done his best for freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And that anybody that was going to suggest, you know, that he was doing it for his own personal purposes, that would hit him very hard.
And okay. What did, but generally on the Nye Bevans and so forth, and Barbara Castles, I mean, he had a a kind of low, a pretty low opinion, did he? Or
not a low opinion. I mean, he could admire them as parliamentarians.
Yes.
But he despised them because of their politics.
Right. Okay.
Because he never thought that in the latter years, do you see, that Labour could rid itself of the unions, could rid itself of strikes and turbulence and all the rest of it in the country. So it was no good for the country as a whole to mm-hmm. have them. And these were, of course, exponents of the socialist theories.
Mm. But they said that, I mean, he was depressed because when things didn't go right and all the rest of it. I mean, were there any outward signs, or what outward signs were there of that?
Yes, he'd be quite despondent and very low in spirits when things went wrong.
Mm. And how would it be?
No, he would just slump in the chair, yeah. And he would be uncommunicative.
Mm.
And one could guess. And it wasn't as if it was... There were several different facets of despondency as far as Churchill was concerned. Some of it lasted and some of it was very brief. If his horse didn't win,
yes,
he'd be disappointed rather than despondent. But it'd be with him for a while, and then he'd suddenly say, well, I'm quite sure the horse did its best, you see.
Right.
And so I remember when Colonist down at Brighton came in fourth out of four, having hurt its leg with a loose plate, do you mm-hmm. see? And so it did its best. But prior to the race, I think it was that one, Churchill talked, you know, in my presence, when he was talking to Churchill in the ring, talking to Colonist in the ring, you know, threatened him that if he didn't win, he'd be sent to stud, you see? And then afterwards he said, no wonder he didn't win, do you see? He hopes to go to stud.
Yes, exactly.
And so a brief disappointment, you see, would last not for very long.
Yes, and then?
But if it was family, it would probably last quite a time, such time as Lady Churchill would see him in the lounge or even go to his bedroom, you know, to sort of kiss and make up.
Mm.
And then there'd be giggles and chortles and a brilliant smile on his face, and you know, his eyebrows would go up, and there would be tears in his eyes without any weeping, shall we say. But you could see that he was terribly happy that the little war had come to an end. But during the time that there was a family quarrel, then, and this wasn't very often, I mean, it's like, it was married life.
Yes.
You see? Mm. They had their ups and downs, they had their little differences. But during that period, he wouldn't talk much, he'd sort of look up at me and wonder, you know, and, well, what do you think of it all? And I would hasten to turn around and go somewhere else. You know, I wasn't going to get involved in any of his despondent moves. But if it was during party politics, you could see him. He was despondent, but his face would keep on. You could see him wondering, why on earth, do you see, was he so nasty to me? You know, I never did him any wrong, whether he was right or wrong, do you see, and whether he'd done any wrong or not. Mm. But he was egotistic, shall we say, really,
and
up to a point.
When he was in Prime Minister, I mean, with these, how is it notable then? With you would have thought
different character, different kettle of fish altogether, because he was the boss, and he knew he was right all the time. So, you know, if people, then there were wholehearted arguments. Do you see? There was a fight going on. Something that he put his reasons, and other people put their reasons, and they discussed it, and he knew that he was eventually coming out on top.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no question of despondency when he was in power at cabinet meetings or things like that. But in the House, these people could say nasty things that he'd been self...
Yeah. Selfish or...
Self-centered.
Self-inspired.
Yes.